We might get started. Welcome to Concurrent Session 6C, titled Art or Science, Industry Approaches to Tax in Unit Pricing. My name's Martin Paino, and I'll be the chair for this session. Today's presenter is Michael Dermody. Michael works at KPMG as well in Sydney and has advised on a number of unit pricing projects over many years. So I'll hand over to Michael.
Thanks, Martin, and good afternoon, everyone. Given the limited time in these sessions, I plan to go over some of the key points of the paper, hopefully within 20 minutes, and then leave as much time as possible over for discussion. Within unit pricing, tax is a particular area of interest for actuaries because of the need to exercise judgment and develop approximate models in order to deal with limitations in data. Judgment is also required in order to allocate the overall sort of tax expense at the overall VPST or superannuation fund level down to each of the investment options that are unit priced. So in addition to these areas where actuaries and others have been ongoing interest sort of in tax and unit pricing, the global financial crisis and the resulting investment falls across all of the broad asset classes that superannuation is invested in has created a new range of issues for managers to deal with in terms of the valuation and the recovery of deferred tax assets. And in this session, I actually plan to focus mainly on the deferred tax asset valuation issues, which is a very topical issue, but we'll also go over some of the other issues that are covered in the paper, some of the issues around how managers set approximate approaches to calculate the unit price, how they go about comparing and reconciling that approximate unit price calculation to a more detailed calculation that's used for the tax return or for accounts. And then very quickly over some practical issues in terms of tax payments as well as parcel selection. Okay, but just before we get into the main content of the session, it's probably worth going over very quickly for those who aren't already very familiar how tax fits into unit pricing. So for tax funds, such as superannuation business, the tax calculation needs to include an allowance for tax based on current asset values in order to allow for equitable unit pricing across generations of unit holders. And most of the complexity in tax and unit pricing applies particularly to superannuation business. And there's two main reasons for that within the tax rules. The first of all is the different tax treatment for capital gains, depending upon the holding period for the assets. So 15% basically for assets held for less than 12 months or 10% for assets held for more than 12 months. And then the other complexity around the tax rules for superannuation is that capital losses only have value to the extent that they can be set off against capital gains. So that complexity in terms of the tax rules, then flows into complexity in terms of the amount of data and the calculations that are required in order to do a reasonable tax calculation every day. And I won't go through all the aspects of this diagram, and it is just a hypothetical system framework, if you like, just an example system framework from the paper. I will just highlight a couple of points. Obviously, there's the unit pricing system there in the middle, and that's getting fed every day a tax provision from a daily tax model, which might be an approximate calculation, which is going into the unit pricing system. And then every month or every quarter, a more detailed tax model is run. And that's reconciled with the daily model, and differences flowed into the unit pricing system. And then similarly, when the tax return is done, another reconciliation, and again, differences flowed back into the unit pricing system. So that's a very brief background of how tax fits into unit pricing. And all that complexity around data management and reconciliations are issues that managers have been dealing with over the past several years, you know, since unit pricing blew up as a major risk management issue. However, the key tax issue for managers at the moment is around the recoverability and the valuation of deferred tax assets. And that's a new issue, because it's the first time really that managers have had such large and broadly based asset losses. So, as I said, DTA valuation and monitoring are really the key issues around tax and unit pricing at the moment. And the paper considers four issues in relation to the valuation and monitoring of deferred tax assets. And the first and the one we'll probably spend the most time on is looking at what's the nature of this deferred tax asset. And given the nature of that asset, what are the implications that that has for the valuation approach that we should be using? And the paper looks at that in terms of comparing the current sort of standard industry approaches with the values and results produced by a more sophisticated stochastic model. The second key issue that managers are dealing with is what's the level of the analysis? When we're doing this analysis, what level should we do it at? Should we look at each unit pricing option that we're calculating a unit price for, each investment option we're calculating a unit price for? Or should we do the DTA sort of recoverability and monitoring at the overall super fund or VPST level, which it might have, you know, potentially hundreds of individual investment options within it? We'll also look at the frequency of the monitoring, as well as the issue of discounting of time value of money and how they should be factored into the overall DTA valuation. Okay, so in terms of capital losses and the nature of the asset, capital losses, they only have value to the extent they can be set off against capital gains. And therefore, a key aspect to assessing the value is the risk that the fund won't earn enough capital gains in future. And on that basis, many managers recognise deferred tax assets, but then consider capping those assets when they've reached a certain level. And the common or the most common formula that we're aware of that people use for determining that cap is based on that formula there. So managers say, okay, well, what expected growth rate do I have for the assets that I hold? What's a reasonable recovery period in order to get that deferred tax asset back? And then what's the tax rate? So an example might be, okay, I expect my assets to grow at 4%. 5 years is a reasonable, you know, recovery period. And then a 10% tax rate. And that would give it a 2% effectively, you know, DTA cap level. And the interesting thing about a cap level is some people treat that as a hard cap. So they say, right, as soon as my DTA gets to 2%, I'm not going to recognise any further value for those losses. That's the finish of it. People can even, if they like, hard code that value into their systems. And a number of other managers treat that level as a trigger. So it gets to that level, the 2% level, and then an expert such as an actuary will come along and say, okay, we've got to that level, where's the fund at, and what considerations are there, and maybe I will or maybe I won't recognise the DTA in terms of if asset values continue to fall. So there's some judgment there even after the cap or trigger level is reached. Okay, however, that calculation is obviously a very simple formula for what is actually a very complex asset. And it's an asset that has very different returns, so the value that a fund is going to get out of its losses is very different. It's very different depending upon what the actual outcome of capital growth in the future is, as well as what the fund's applications and redemptions profile is. So it's a very simple formula, very complex asset. So what we did, and what's in the paper, is we tried to look at, okay, well, you know, what are the implications if one used a stochastic model? And we adapted one of our option pricing models in order to perform this analysis. And the main features of that model are it's based on sort of a 6-year recovery period, so similar to that 5 years, mainly equity-based portfolio with a 30% volatility. And there's other assumptions around, you know, risk-free discount rates and the dividend yields from those asset classes. They're all in the appendix to the paper for those that are interested in them. And so then what we did was the other important assumption that was used in the model is we assumed zero future applications and redemptions. So it was basically no outflows or inflows. So the results of that valuation analysis are shown in this graph here. And so what it shows here on the x-axis is just the full nominal value. What's the DTA, assuming no discounting for time value money fix and no risk of non-recovery. And so obviously under the simplified approach, which is shown in the red line, very simple. We recognise the full value of the deferred tax asset up to the cap, and then as losses increase, now the DTA just stays at the 2% cap level. Pretty simple stuff. The blue line shows the DTA value produced by the stochastic analysis. And what that shows, not surprisingly, is that the value of the DTA continues to increase as the losses increase. But they increase at a decreasing rate. And the fact that they increase at a decreasing rate is a reflection of two factors. First of all, as losses increase, the likelihood of earning sufficient capital gains in future decreases. That's no surprise. But the other factor that it reflects is the time value of money effects. So the deferred tax asset is a non-income producing asset, and as we increase our losses, the time period to recovery of that non-income producing asset just gets pushed out further and further. Okay, so the purpose of this analysis then was to also highlight where the greatest differences between the two valuation approaches are likely to occur. And they're likely to occur at or around the cap level, where the simplified approach is just giving full value, no allowance for risk of recovery, no allowance for time value of money discounting. And the second place where differences are likely to be greatest is where the losses are very large and the simple cap method is just giving zero value. Even when the losses become massive, it's not giving any value to those additional losses. And we would certainly contend, or we'd certainly say that the analysis behind that stochastic model and the assumptions behind it, they're very subjective. There's assumptions in there like, you know, risk-free discount rates and volatilities. You can get that from market data or historic data. Some of the other assumptions around how long is the projection period, what allowance for applications, redemptions, that's more of a challenge and is more subjective. But the point of this analysis was to really just highlight the shape of the curve. So in a sense, that those other issues are secondary for the purposes of this analysis. And given that subjectivity, a lot of people might say, oh, well, you know, this is all so airy-fairy, it's also difficult. If they're materially close together, it doesn't really matter which one we choose. And I think there's certainly, we'd agree with that approach and that set out in the paper. What this does highlight, though, is I think for people that are at one end or the other of industry practice. Say, for example, if you have a very large cap, okay, and your nominal loss is around the cap level, then this analysis might be telling you something. And similarly, for those fund managers who've got a very small cap but massive losses, are you, by that process, allowing people to come in and ride a massive 30% gain to the market without any tax effects because you haven't given any value to the DTA? Okay, so that's a couple of points on the overall valuation approach. The second key issue that managers are dealing with at the moment is around what level of, do we do the analysis at? And some people have got approaches that focus more on the investment options, some people at the overall super fund or VPST level. Advantage of the DTA level is that's the level we need to unit price at. But really, the tax law doesn't recognise all of these internal accounting structures that we've set up, and effectively losses in one investment option can be set off against gains in another investment option. And in fact, what many fund managers have in their tax and unit pricing policy is rules around the value that loss gets exchanged for with the gain-making sector, which some people refer to as loss selling. So on that basis, that we've got a policy under the tax law, we're allowed to do this offsetting, it would seem reasonable to at least consider an overall, VPST or superannuation fund analysis and not just have analysis focused on individual investment options. Problem, though, with approaches that focus on the overall super fund or the overall VPST is that underneath that, and this has happened, underneath that, individual investment options can sometimes have very, very large deferred tax assets. They can become quite massive. So 2% overall cap, but then individual investment options getting above 10%. And that leads to very large DTAs at the investment option level, leads to three risks that are discussed in the paper. The first one is obviously there's asset allocation effects. The DTA is a non-income producing asset, doesn't link to the assets under the mandate. So we can have issues where we're outside what we've disclosed to unit holders in terms of the strategic asset allocations we said we'd have. Okay, so clearly that's a significant and a fairly obvious, in a way, problem that can emerge. The second issue is that some of the points that are immaterial at the overall fund level where DTAs are small suddenly become much more material when we've got a larger DTA for the investment option. So an example of that is the time value of money effects. Small DTA, small time value of money effects, large DTA, question mark, and probably, obviously, it becomes much more significant. The third issue, which some people may not probably be as aware of, is that, and is more of a hidden issue, is that when the investment option level DTA gets very, very large, if fund circumstances change or the manager's view of recoverability changes, we can end up with a big DTA write-down. So the unit price can get impacted because we've changed our view of DTA recoverability or something's happened to the fund. And that's a risk that often unit holders haven't been notified of and aren't expecting. So there's issues there around what have we disclosed and what are we doing in terms of monitoring in order to, you know, to manage that issue. It's definitely a difficult issue. Okay, there's sort of a few other key issues around deferred tax assets, and I'll just go through these very quickly. The first one was selecting a tax rate. Obviously, we said, well, losses, the value depends upon the gain they get set off against. It could be 10, could be 15. A lot of managers use a weighted average. Some managers are saying, well, let's just use a 10% rate. Maybe that's an implicit allowance for time value of money or non-recoverability. I don't know. The second one we'll talk about in a moment is the discounting. I'll talk about that right now. The discounting effect is far more significant for deferred tax assets than for deferred tax liabilities. So in the regulator's guide, the regulator acknowledged that discounting might be appropriate. But what's interesting is that among all of the people that were discounting deferred tax provisions, they've actually started to move to not discounting. And that's fine. There's advantages of not discounting. One of the advantages of not discounting, well, a lot of the clear advantages are the fact that it's consistent with accounting treatments, avoids complexities around reconciliations. But probably most importantly, and something a lot of people won't be aware of, is that not discounting is quite good where you've got a deferred tax liability and you close the fund or you get a large redemption. Okay, and the reason for that is when you have a large redemption, you're going to sell the assets, potentially pay the benefits. It brings forward the capital gains tax the capital gains tax calculation, which matches what you're doing in unit pricing. So very nice. Don't need to worry about a large cash outflow or closing the fund. That's great. Problem is, doesn't work when the deferred tax is an asset. When the deferred tax is an asset, and we sell assets, get lots of cash paid out, what happens? Instead of bringing forward the receipt of the tax associated with it, it actually pushes it out, it does the opposite. So the time value of money effects become greater rather than smaller. So that's that's definitely an issue for people to consider where they're not discounting where the DTAs are large. Monitoring, I think the main point there is a lot of systems can't look across unit series and can't do a daily calculation, and therefore people need to download data. They don't have enough time to do these calculations every day and work out where the deferred tax asset is at relative to the cap. So they need to decide sort of, what the frequency of monitoring is, and what we suggested in the paper was potentially having some thresholds around cash flows and asset returns, so that if something happens between your formal review dates, that you actually capture that and update the deferred tax asset. Okay, so that's some points. That's the points on deferred tax assets. I'll just quickly go over some of the other points in the paper around method. APRA recognised that unit pricing and tax and unit pricing can be approximate. What we found was interesting was that a lot of people actually developed quite detailed approaches for some parts of the calculation. Some people have managed to get out of their accounting systems, actual cost bases, actual market values, actual holding periods every day, and done a detailed calculation every day, which is fantastic. A lot of other fund managers are using a fairly simple rate times earning approach to update the tax calculation every day, and are saying, well, basically, there's parts of the tax calculation such as distributions from ordinary trusts, etc., which we don't know. They're going to be an estimate anyway, so why bother trying to get this other capital gains tax calculation really precise? But anyway, some managers have found it useful. The paper mentions some advantages, notwithstanding the fact that some parts will end up some advantages of those detailed approaches. And I'll just skip over some of those. Obviously, because it's basically the idea is because it's more similar to the detailed calculation, it's going to end up being a better comparison with it and help you identify errors. Imputation credits. I'll just quickly mention a few points around imputation credits. First of all is the timing issue. The regulators sort of envisage two potential methods of recognising imputation credits. Doing it every day. Okay, so every day adding an amount to the accrual for imputation credits, or alternatively just to only recognise it based on an ex-distribution date or an ex-dividend date. Most people have gone with the ex-date, even though that may not be what the regulator was hoping for, but most people have gone with that legal entitlement basis, and that's in line. That's then quite robust. If they have large outflows, they haven't given away value that they didn't end up sort of getting. The other key points and issues around imputation credit recognition are the use of preliminary information. Sometimes fund managers will send you a statement with some estimated information. Sometimes you might be investing in a trust which is managed by an asset manager within your group. Do you use that information? The last point there was around timing of updating. So the annual tax statements when you're investing in these trusts come through after their year end. They come through at different times. Do people wait till they've got all of them before putting the adjustment through, or do they sort of look at their statement and say, oh, I've got this one, that's different to the estimate, put that one through, and then just keep putting them through as the statements come through? Okay. Just quickly on reconciliations, all I'll say on this point is that there's two camps of groups, really. There's people who do the reconciliation between their unit pricing model and their tax return or accounts model. The two camps are people who do it approximately, and there are those that have actually managed to get their systems going well enough to do it so sophisticated that they actually quantify all the impacts and leave no unexplained. So they've quantified all of the methodology and data and differences and quantify those and bridge that entire reconciliation. Okay, I'll probably skip over the allocation issues. The main points there are that most managers are allocating all of the differences that come through that reconciliation back to the investment options, and they're trying to draw on the basis of where those differences came from. A couple of points just on practical issues around tax payments. Most people are now paying tax out of their funds quarterly in line with the BAS payments, and some life insurers are using a current tax basis, some people are using the actual BAS basis, so that's an area of difference. And the point I'll just finish on is parcel selection. So again, it's an area where there's difference. Some people are doing first in, first out when they sell half of their BHP parcel, and some people are using optimised, maximised gain, minimised loss. So that concludes the presentation. I'll hand back to Martin.
All right, let's open up for some questions. Any questions? Rob?
Michael, thank you for an informative presentation. It's led to me for a few few comments and questions, so I might have to pause to give you a chance, because sometimes, you know, if you ask too many in a row, it gets confusing. Mostly around the DTA, I sort of had a question really on the stochastic approach. So we've had discussions with a number of clients. Very rarely have I ever seen anybody use a stochastic model or stochastic approach. I just wondered what your experience was, because theoretically, yes, the larger the loss, the greater the probability of recovery, and therefore the larger the DTA. But you also mentioned complexity. As a result, I've rarely seen it implemented that the stochastic model is actually used.
Yep.
You're going to answer it,
yeah. Oh, yeah, okay, I can have a go at answering it. So we have seen some people use stochastic, not stochastic, probably more scenario-based analysis. But still, you know, there's the option there if you've got sort of five scenarios, then probably weighting them and discounting them back. I think, you know, there's an issue there that people are really flying a bit blind and they haven't developed their approaches. So we've got people just, you know, 10 years times 5%, like they're just picking numbers out of anywhere. Other people are just saying, oh, that's because this is what someone else used. Some people are inventing their own scenarios and saying, well, we had an asset fall, therefore the market's going to recover 30%, you know, and what this does is put a bit of science then around those and say, well, you know, you wouldn't say, oh, BHP is now trading at $10, but I'm not going to value it at unit pricing at $10, I'm going to value it at $30 because the market's going to recover, okay, and it's the same sort of idea here, just putting a bit more science and market consistent sort of approach around the DTA and stopping people doing really, really silly things.
Moving on to the other area. One of the other areas around DTA was the option level caps as opposed to funds or VPST fund level. I have seen the challenge done, and it really comes down to your philosophy. If you have a philosophy around not pooling between the different options, then there's a lot more focus on the individual option level caps as opposed to something across the VPST. Or it's more actually, to be fair, in the funds and the industry type funds really don't look so much about selling the tax benefits from one fund to the other, and therefore in terms of setting their capping policies have done a lot more at an individual option level.
Sorry, Rob, where do they go?
What they tend to do is go down at the option level without having...
Yeah, but where does the benefit go then when it happens?
Well, you see, because we're now looking at a particular scenario where everybody's in loss, there is no benefit to go, so therefore they've just set the different levels at this point in time going forwards. Because, you know, they haven't actually got to the stage where there may be some benefits in one area and deficits in others. So it's really their view of pooling is that this would actually eventually flow through to each individual fund rather than having the sort of cross sharing. There may be some short term effects, but it really belongs to the individual option.
Yeah.
So it's more about theoretical projection as opposed to looking at what's occurred in the last year or something like that.
Yeah, well, the main comment I have with that is that, you know, the APRA's guide says that you should allocate tax differences at the overall fund level back to the investment options. So ultimately, the tax has got to go back.
Yeah.
Okay, now if you've got a fund which has got massive losses, but one's got gains, and they're both realised, then you know when you get to the year end, they're going to match off. And then in your tax and unit pricing, you have to have a rule about the value that gets done at. And what we're saying is that most people's rules, and we say that in the paper, most people's rules are to do it at a nominal rate. So this guy might have had losses that he couldn't have, no way in the world, recovered on a standalone basis if he had just kept going. And he set them off against gains over here. What most people do is they say, right, you get 10% of that loss. And if that's your rule, what we're saying is if that's your rules, then when you're doing valuation and monitoring, it should reflect those rules. Now, in the paper, we also talk about you don't have to have that rule. Yeah. You could have a rule that says we're going to do this loss selling on the basis of how this loss-making sector should value that loss.
Yeah, and I think that's the way many industry funds approach this, actually, as opposed to retail business. They look at it as a loss belonging to a particular option.
So yeah,
just a different approach.
Yeah,
I mean, I was going to say that quite often on the retail side, I've seen both applied. Sorry, Mike. I've seen both actually applied to the so that you have a fund level cap, which is then applied at an option level as well, so that you you're able to manage both. One, to ensure that you don't end up with too large a particular DTA on a particular option.
Yeah, all I'd say is that the valuation approach should reflect what actually happens, and the step before that is that the rules that you've got for loss selling should be set up in advance and should be fair. Yep.
Bruce Thompson, I'd just like to pursue that idea about loss selling. Yes, I have for years been in line with what I've observed has been normal industry practice, and that is to, if you like, to sell the losses at full nominal or face value. I've done that on the belief that there's usually been one pool that has the loss and lots of pools with profits that are happy to, if you like, do the trade. And so, although it is an internal trade with one seller and lots of buyers, it's a seller's market, and so the price gets bid up something pretty close to full nominal value, and so the rule set in advance has been to sell them at 100%. 2009, I suspect, is going to be rather different to that, though, in that I suspect there's going to be lots of pools or even entities wanting to sell losses and not very many buyers. The parallel that comes to mind is back in, I think it was about 1992 or something or other like that, when the major banks had made big losses. Those of us who were out there with tax-positive entities in that year were doing wonderful deals with the likes of Westpac that were called leverage leases and things like that, and we were buying jumbo jets for Qantas and getting huge yields because we were taking advantage of the fact that there was what was for us at the time a buyer's market. There was lots of people out there with losses. We were taking advantage of those. Tax avoidance legislation has changed between then and now. So for arm's length transactions like that, they'll have to be done differently, but I'm a great believer in the ability of all those currently unemployed financial engineers out there to come up with ways of doing this. But I suspect that we may end up with a situation rather more like the 1990s, where face value is not achievable for your losses because there's so many people with losses. I'd love to hear whether other people have been having those sorts of thoughts.
Well, Bruce, I think that's sort of reflecting a different way of looking at it. So that's sort of saying, okay, well, we've got a market. Let's value this at loss and let's do this loss sale now based on the market as it is now. And what we talked about in the paper is actually about setting up rules in advance. So there's a difference between sort of a priori and ex post situation. So if you've set up rules in advance, everyone's in a stable position. No one's got investment losses or gains. Okay, if you set up a rule that says, okay, we're going to exchange losses on a nominal basis, then they're the rules that you set up in advance. So it's fair to everyone, even if later on it looks as though it might have favoured the loss-making sector. It actually hasn't because you set the rules up front. And I think that was really an important finding, is that you make the rules up front and then, you know, in the event, it might look like you're favouring one or the other, but really, when you started out, there was an equal chance that this sector or that sector would have had, you know, losses or gains. So that was how we looked at it, and that's why we're talking with Rob around, you know, setting the rules up and the valuation approach reflecting the rules that you've got.
My name is Ramani. I'm from APRA. Some of the comments I'm going to make are not necessarily an APRA view. I think it would be helpful when we talk about these issues not to specifically label it as unit pricing issues, because almost all the issues which have been talked about apply whether you are unitized or you use crediting rates. I think there is a view gaining ground that somehow unit pricing is a little more sexy and therefore is a little more complex. The underlying substantive issues are identical whether you use crediting rates or unit prices. Just a comment. Secondly, in relation to either unit pricing or crediting rates, there are a whole host of assumptions, some of which are realized and some of which are not realized. It's important that when trustees and their advisors talk about these issues, they have a clear idea of what kind of tolerance or approximation they are prepared to achieve and have policies and procedures which at the very least explain it to themselves, more preferably explain it to the regulators when they come and ask them, and most importantly are able to explain it to members if they say, how the hell did you calculate this? I don't understand. Under the law, members have got a right to understand their entitlements. Now, this is where I think professionals, including actuaries, can do a lot. A specific point which we are still debating around is with reference to DTA. Looks a bit odd to raise this at the current state of the market, but when within a fund, when people move from accumulation to pension, either because they are completely retired or because they are taking a transition to retirement pension, in the past in accumulation they would have been charged an amount for deferred tax as in respect to their unrealized capital gains, even though that looks a bit of a pie in the sky in these markets. But within the same fund, which is the same tax entity, when they move into a pension stage, what happens to that? That deferred tax, which is a book provision, which has really nothing to do with the tax office at all, how does that get distributed back? Does it get distributed across to all members, accumulation and pension? And what level of equity is that? And most importantly, coming back to my earlier point, if a member came and said, look, now I am in pension, I understand under the tax laws, any unrealized capital gains are no longer taxable, can I get some of those deferred tax provisions back? What the hell do trustees and the professional advisors say? Thank you.
Well, just picking up that last point, I see it very much as an extension of the first point around loss selling. On the point of who should get any particular benefits because of the no longer you can effectively not have to pay capital gains tax if you keep assets unrealised until you move to pension phase, or different fund managers are doing different things. You know, you've got Navigator and other platforms that are out there quite publicly saying we try and give you exactly, you know, your benefit for you, and you've got other people there that are effectively not allocating back to individual people the benefits from those DTAs and spreading them. In terms of your other points, I don't think I've got much to say other than that I agree with them. I might just 1 second come back to Bruce's point that you said about around market trading. And I think, to me, that's what highlights the importance of setting up rules in advance. If you don't set up rules in advance and then you end up in this position of doing lost trades, then you're writing history, and that's the importance of actually saying up front, well, how is this loss selling going to get done? Otherwise, you potentially look like you're advantaging the loss-making sector, because you're just writing the rules, you know, and you're already in a position where one fund's in a gain and one fund's in a loss.
Hi, Wade Tubman. IFSA did a recent survey of DTAs, and a lot of the results corroborate what you were saying. A lot of people just do use a simple rate without discounting. So I think it was interesting there that there has been this move away from what you call more sophisticated approaches. Two things came out of that survey, though, that were quite interesting, and I want to get your views on them. One was sort of an accusation that was made that some people are actually sort of manipulate their DTA policy to actually advantage performance, because obviously writing off DTAs has a performance impact. So that was one thing that was levelled. The other one was around disclosure of DTAs, and I think you're getting towards that. Should a fund have to disclose its DTA levels? But the flip side of that is, if you did, you have this opportunity for arbitrage, which you referred to, where members could come into funds that are sitting on large capped DTA and then basically benefit at the expense of the existing investors. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Okay, I might just answer the... Thanks for your question. Well, I might just deal with the second question first around disclosure. I think that is definitely a key challenge at the moment. Some funds have got large DTAs. If fund circumstances change, if they find they need to write them off, unit holders are going to see a massive change in the unit price and wonder, what the hell? I thought I was exposed to, you know, equity risk, that's fine. I didn't expect it. What's this DTA? I don't even know what you're talking about. So there's definitely a disclosure and a unit holder sort of issue there. In terms of, I mean, if the DTA is fairly valued, and that's sort of what this presentation is trying to get to, if the DTA is fairly valued, then people should be happy to come in or go out of a fund. And that comes back to, you know, I know your presentation last time about, you know, property valuations. The key issue is that if you had inside knowledge, if you knew everything, you should be happy whether you were coming in or going out. You should be indifferent to it because it's been valued properly. And I think that whole issue about equity and unit pricing, and that being the focus of unit pricing, has been missed by a lot of people in the industry. It's about equitable, it's about fairness, and if it's been done properly, then you don't have that much to worry about. And in terms of the IFSA survey manipulating performance, I haven't seen that, but I might catch you after the session.
Any more questions? Okay, all right. Well, I'm sure you'll agree with me that this presentation's been very informative, so please join with me in thanking Michael.